You're listening to the Cycling Podcast at the Vuelta a España in association with Rafa. Today we are in La Covadilla.
Where are we, Daniel?
La Covadilla.
Paint a picture in words for our listeners.
But it's the most life lo-fi ski resort I've ever seen in my entire life, Lionel. You got one grey brick building, which looks like it's seen better days, which I guess is the main hub for the ski resort. And there's another sort of cafeteria from which the ski lifts depart. It's like a short journey they make, isn't it, the ski lifts? It's only probably probably gains about 100 metres in altitude. But it's quite stark, quite windy up here. It's very green, but there are no trees. And we have fantastic views of the plain on all sides from up here.
Yeah, I'll echo that about the ski resort. I was expecting it to be much more infrastructure up here. And even the ski runs themselves are not long. I mean, it really is a kind of a village fate version of a skiing resort. And as I say that, the Vuelta's village fate version of the publicity caravan is coming in. It seems to consist of about 8 vehicles here at the Vuelta. I thought you were going to drop me in it yesterday when I did describe the Vuelta as a bit village compared to the Tour and even the Giro, but it is noticeably more homely. And I think this is the first I was expecting.
Homely, homespun. You can say this because you're getting out tomorrow. You're escaping to Madrid Airport tonight, aren't you? So you can drop one final bomb and off you go.
I've enjoyed it a lot, and I've seen a different part of Spain the last couple of days, but they really have raced us across from the coast up here to not far off Salamanca. We came through a couple of regions. I drove through a bit of Extremadura this morning, even though the race doesn't go into that territory. Came across there, and I mean, this to me looks like the green is reminiscent almost of Dartmoor. It's just a bit more rugged, a bit higher peak. It's a bit more dramatic.
A bit more dramatic. It's 1,500 metres above sea level. Dartmoor rises to about 200 metres, if you're lucky.
Yeah, but what I mean, how high it is.
There's grass and there are some rocks.
What I mean is how high we are up is not really reflected by our view, nor is this peak, it doesn't tower above us like, you know, the Alps or the Dolomites or the Pyrenees even. Okay. It feels gentler, but there's nothing gentle about that climb. I'd never seen it before, and I think one of the things that covering the Giro and the Vuelta in the last couple of years has taught me is that you watch these stages on TV and you make all sorts of assumptions about the climbs and how the race might be tackled, and you realise that I've realised certainly that I knew far less about these types of climbs than the ones at the Tour that I've seen many years. You kind of know, oh, this is a steep bit, this is where it gets really difficult. The bottom of this climb, from about 10 kilometres to go to 7 kilometres to go, I think is significantly a significant challenge. No, there were some really steep turns.
Yeah, it's a real toboggan. There are some horrible sections where you turn a corner and the road rears up in front of you for 400-500 metres, and then it flattens significantly. It's really a series of 400 or 500 metre climbs, little walls, and then there's time and there's room to relax and, well, recover a little bit, and then it goes up again, and it's like that pretty much all the way.
Our Dutch colleague Dan Hakkenberg, who we'll probably hear from a little bit later on, he said that he drove the last sort of 40 kilometres and that there's a little moor, a cobbled moor on the approach to this. I'm looking forward to seeing that on the TV. I hope he wasn't pulling my leg there. I've got to assume he wasn't. But this is stage 9 of the Vuelta. The closest it goes to Madrid, I think, before the actual finish in Madrid in a couple of weeks' time. This is my virtual and metaphorical Madrid, because it's my last day on the Vuelta, going home tomorrow, handing over Madison handsling style to the buffalo. In fact, if you hear, you can just about hear the hooves in the distance, and that isn't the Osborne Bulls from Andalusia, that is the buffalo.
4-2 now, by the way, 4-2 the score. Osborne Bull beating Decathlon. Do we need to explain this again? Playing a very puerile, childish game of I Spy in our car. Branches of Decathlon, my favourite sports superstore, the only sports superstore really, isn't it? Versus Osborne, Bull, billboards, advertising, Spanish vermouth.
Yeah, we had an Osborne Tempranillo last night, didn't we? And it was okay, but it wasn't...
We'd had some very hefty humi, as in Murcia, and it was a bit of a... In terms of body, in terms of sort of tannins, it was a step down, wasn't it?
It was. It was a bit wishy-washy, as the Spanish reds go. Anyway, I think there's around 35 kilometres still to go here. We're waiting for the race. It set off this morning from Talavera de la Reina, 200 kilometres. I think that makes it the longest stage of the race so far. And the break that's up the road has 11 riders in it, including Ben King, Bauke Mollema, Luis Mas, Dylan Teuns, Rito Hollenstein, Thomas de Gendt, and Luis Angel Mate. Who else? For the second time in this race, Dimension Data's Ben King is the virtual red jersey on the road. He was well up the road on the stage 4 to Alfaguara, where he won the stage and for a long time was the virtual red jersey, the race leader on the road. This time, well, he's comfortably in the lead at the moment because the break went up over 10 minutes after they came over the first big climb. He's 6:34 down overall, and the break is currently around about 9 minutes 40. Unlikely that he's going to hold on to the red jersey, but what chance do you give the break of making it up there with the advantage they've got?
I think they should make it, Lionel. Certainly with some of the riders in there, Bauke Mollema has come here looking for a stage win. He went very close a couple of days ago when he was beaten by Simon Clark in the sprint, and this suits him perfectly, doesn't it? He also took the leader's jersey here in, was it 2011, the only time he's ever held the leader's jersey in a Grand Tour, I think.
Well, Dan Martin won here in 2011, didn't he? So, well, he'll be in the group with the GC riders, I guess, and may not get a chance at the stage win, if you're correct there. I think they will hang on, but I think it's going to be quite close. What should we give them? It'll be under a minute by the top.
Ooh, I think it'll be more than that.
Really?
Yeah, I think it'll be more like two.
Okay, I'll say a minute, you say two. Listen on to the podcast. Well, you'll probably know already what's happened. In fact, listeners, you already know what's happened, I'm assuming.
From grand tours to group rides, the Champs-Élysées to coffee shops, Rafa exists to celebrate the world's most beautiful sport.
Thanks to Rafa for sponsoring the cycling podcast. If you would like to go on a Rafa cycling holiday, check out rafa.cc/travel. They've got a lot of holidays planned for 2019, some of them in Spain. Most of those are in Girona, but also one in the Basque country. Some of them are on gravel, so taking you off the beaten track. Different types of trips for different types of cyclists. Some are more relaxed than others, but check out the full programme of holidays on rafa.cc/travel. I think if Ben King was going on a cycling holiday, he would want to go to Alfaguara in just above Granada, and he'd want to come here, Daniel. You called it a few days ago, talking about Ben King's first stage win for Dimension Data here at the Vuelta. You said you wouldn't be surprised if he'd get another one.
Well, yeah, Lionel, it was in response to our August colleague, Fran Reyes, poo-pooing. Well, not, he didn't really poo-poo Ben King. He said that Ben King would not have been the kind of rider who he would have thought would win a stage of the Vuelta before this race, or a stage in a Grand Tour indeed. And I immediately had a bit of a hunch that there might be a parallel with Tomasz Martyński last year, the Polish rider who got a stage win pretty early. And it wouldn't shock me to see Ben King in a break again, and it wouldn't shock me to see him very relaxed, confident, with nothing to lose, and a threat in another stage. I don't know what it is about the Vuelta. We've seen it happen here a few times. I remember a Russian rider called Andrei Zinchenko, when he was riding, I think, for Vitalicia Siguros about 15 years ago or more, did a similar thing. And that was really based on just the sort of confidence a rider who gets an unexpected breakaway win takes from that, and how they're decision-making becomes just a lot more lucid, and also I think their judgment of their own effort becomes more lucid with that confidence, And you know, I put that to Ben King at the finish line when I spoke to him, and he said, well, no, he knew from training Prices for Vuelta how much he could suffer and how deep he could go. But then he did sort of concede that the psychological factor of the pressure being off and not being flustered because he's already had a fantastic Vuelta, that did play a part.
Yeah, I don't like drawing attention to all the things you've got right, Daniel, but you were also closer in terms of how far the gap between the brake and the GC riders would come down. I thought they might blow up a bit on the climb, particularly the bottom section, but actually, Ben King certainly, and Bauke Mollema, who was chasing him all the way up, and Dylan Teuns, who was the only other one from the nine-man brake who managed to outrun the GC riders. It was 2.5 minutes plus.
I think it was a great climb for a breakaway, simply because, as you mentioned earlier, the nature of the climb was such that you could focus, or a breakaway rider could focus on short efforts for maybe 30, 40 seconds, short stretches of 300, 400 metres that were steep, and then ease off a bit as they came to the false flats, which pretty much invariably followed all the way up the climb. And I don't know if that's how Ben King managed it, but I can well imagine that helped him. The fact that he was never on this climb, you're never just sort of lost in the middle of an indefinite period stretch of suffering.
Yeah, I mean, it was a barnstorming last 20, 25 kilometres. And I think what you say about Ben King, maybe not just the confidence, but also the fact that there's nothing to lose in a situation like that. One stage win already in the bag, pressure's off to a certain degree, and he could afford to go from a long way out and test whether he was strong enough to bring it home. And he was. And he said it was quite a tactical game. Thomas de Gendt was one of the people he was most worried about. He knew Lewis Mass would be strong as well. He was also concerned about Mollema, didn't want Mollema getting ahead of him on the climb, and really it all kind of went just before that little cobbled climb, although the cobbles, there was an easy way out because there was a smooth sort of gutter right up the middle of the road that they could all ride on. But after the break had broken up and sort of come back together again, King really just went for it, didn't he? And as soon as Mass moved, he went. And then once he got onto the climb, he'd got a good advantage. And then as Mollema was sort of reeling him in, Mollema just hit the wall, didn't he? I mean, the gap went down to sort of 19, 18 seconds, and then in very short order back up to 40, 50 seconds.
Yeah, and I think, we've seen Mollema come very close twice this week, and in both situations he's been, if not the most experienced rider in the group, and certainly the rider with the best pedigree in terms of climbing. He hasn't quite managed to pull it off, and I think it's probably just a question of condition. He's not quite at his best. He also rode the Tour de France, might be tired. And I think the same is true of Thomas de Gendt. I don't think he's in his best form at the moment. Spoken to him a couple of times this week, and he's sort of emphasised that point that, yep, in theory there have been a lot of stages that have suited him and have suited a breakaway, but you still need to have the legs, and he hasn't quite got them at the moment.
Well, there are a lot of smiles at the finish here amongst the Dimension Data staff and the riders as they came over the line and realised that Ben King had pulled off a second win in a week. Let's hear briefly from Louis Menkes and Igor Anton, two of King's teammates.
Oh, he just showed what class he has, and yeah, it's absolutely amazing for the team. We've been having it pretty hard, so yeah, it comes as a relief. I think it's really important also just to start off next year again with some more hope. So yeah, there's still a little bit of improvement to go, but much better than all season. So yeah, it's positive, and but also just hoping for a bit more in the next few days.
For sure it's amazing for the team, for him as well, because sometimes he don't have good luck, and now in the Vuelta is all gifts for him, but he fight for that.
Do you think the first win gave him more confidence to go today?
Always in the every teams happen the same, no? It's good.
Yeah, Ben King becoming the breakaway sensation of the Vuelta. He said that last year, although it was a rough year for him, he got into a break in every single stage race that he rode, but none of them went to the line. And the difference here, of course, is that both breaks he's been in went to the line. Of course, that opens up the opportunity to then finish off the stage win. And that's the bit where the thinking starts coming into it. And he did say it was a very tactical finale. He summoned up the inspiration of his former Radio Shack teammate Jens Voigt, Jens Vogt, sorry. The pronunciation police will be on me for that. And it was well thought out, well executed, and you could almost see the sort of relief on the faces of Igor Anton Louis Menkes, who, you know, they would have been the riders shouldering the burden in this race, and kind of pressures off them a little bit too.
Yeah, and I think the breakaway, or riders have got into breakaway, benefited from the fact that this Vuelta is not following the usual, the familiar template of recent Grand Tours, whereby there's either a general classification team or a sprinters team that knows exactly before every stage pretty much exactly what's going to happen, and they almost ride to ensure that that outcome does come to pass. And you know, there's been a few days this week, it wasn't necessarily the case today, but when the profile has been a difficult one to decipher, and we've heard riders talk about unexpected climbs or unexpected sections, they didn't realise how difficult they were, and I think it's just made a few teams quite tentative about really committing. And there are also a few riders who are not in particularly great form. Peter Sagan is one, or he hasn't been in particularly great form, and I think there might have been two fewer breakaways in the last week had Sagan been on good form, and I think Bora would have committed. And also we've seen the effect again of smaller teams. Bora would have committed more throughout this week, I think, if they didn't have Emmanuel Buchmann riding high on German classification, and Davide Formolo as well riding relatively well. So you know, we have definitely seen over the course of this year a change in the way Grand Tours are being ridden by virtue of this eight-man rule.
But they're quite subtle changes, aren't they? And it's not easy at this stage, even after two Grand Tours and a week of the third, to really draw any firm conclusions of exactly what is happening. It's almost like the teams don't want to get caught out. They don't want to risk too much and overcommit. And so we are seeing some slightly unpredictable racing here, certainly.
Don't forget to listen to our morning show, Kilometer Zero, supported by The Economist. Monday, Wednesday and Friday mornings throughout the Vuelta a España.
So Ben King, the stage winner ahead of Mollema, Toynes, they were the breakaway riders. And then after that came the GC group of Miguel Angel Lopez, Nairo Quintana, Wilco Kelderman. I'll talk to Dan Hakkenberg of Algemeen Dagblad, the Dutch newspaper, about Mollema and about Kelderman in a bit. But as expected, Rudy Mollard lost the red jersey. He kind of lost contact, I guess, around halfway up the climb. Difficult to tell exactly where they were, that group, because the distance on the screen, of course, was the breakaway riders. But he lost 6:43 to King, so over 4 minutes to all of the GC riders. Plummets down from first to 17th place. And the new red jersey is Simon Yates of Mitchelton Scott. Led the Giro for a long, long time, of course, was very aggressive there, and finds himself in the red jersey. Said in the press conference this evening that he wasn't expecting to be in this position this evening. 1 second he leads by, leads over Alejandro Valverde and Nairo Quintana. Valverde's teammate, of course, from Movistar, is third at 14 seconds. So there's been a real kind of shuffle. It's almost as if the race dossards, the race numbers, have been taken off the riders' jerseys and put in a washing machine and then plucked out at random, because there's been just riders going up 3-4 places and down 3-4 places. Simon Yates from fourth to first. He's in a really good position here, because there's no real pressure, expectation and so on to necessarily put full resources behind defending that red jersey when the race resumes after the rest day, because they could let it go quite easily. They could they gift Valverde a time bonus? Because presumably Valverde would like some time in the leader's jersey.
Well, yeah, and the other question is, do they need to, in the sense that Valverde, you might say that Valverde's the de facto leader anyway. 1 second really makes no difference. I mean, if they turn around to Movistar and say, look, you know, we don't want to ride, and you can defend Quintana and Valverde's position if you want, you know, maybe that might work. But giving away a second is harder than I think we might imagine. It's also at this stage, second week of the race, it's not as easy to let a breakaway go down the road. And for example, a guy like Ben King is not that far in general classification. Give it to someone like him, and then you would probably only lose it for a day or so anyway, because we've got the higher mountains coming. But it was It was unintentional from Yates, the second time this week when he's gained time or gained something unintentionally. I think he probably would have preferred not to have it. Particularly, you know, we became very aware just watching him day after day after day at the Giro of the sheer volume of media obligations and other obligations that come with having the leader's jersey. And it's not something that he particularly relishes. He coped with it well at the Giro, but he probably wouldn't have wanted to do that again.
It would have been very difficult for him to calculate because riders were all over the place once it started to split up. Who impressed you on that running? Because although Yates gained the jersey, he actually lost a little bit of time. He's not pinging as he was in at this stage of the Giro, but maybe that bodes well. I mean, he was asked in the press conference what he's learnt from the Giro, and he said, well, I don't really know why I blew up so spectacularly, so I'm not terribly sure what I've learnt yet. So I get the sense that there's still a bit of the unknown ahead of him. But in terms of how the GC now looks, I mean, who is now moving into a position to make a challenge for the overall victory?
Well, just the Yates line on what he's learned. I know the one thing that has changed since the Giro is the way that Mitchelson and Scott are thinking about hydration, rehydration and heat. I'm not sure specifically what they've changed, but I know they've revised their protocols on that. And it's been, well, we've talked about little else this week, but the heat, everyone has been talking about the heat. And we saw a correlation in the Giro between Yates's form plummeting, or him not going quite as well, and the temperature rising, didn't we? We thought that might be an issue here, and it hasn't been an issue, so that's encouraging. Otherwise, no one has lost and completely relinquished their chances today. All the riders we thought might have a chance of winning the Giro still have a chance, I would say.
The Giro.
Well, why not? Why not? The Giro.
The Giro of Spain.
You might have expected more. I thought the Lotto and El Jumbo might put people under pressure today. They didn't really, but they also rode pretty well. Buchmann lost a bit of time, but he looks as though he's here to stay in the lead group. I think Rigoberto Urán, if you're a Rigoberto Urán fan, then his performances so far have been encouraging, because he can blow a bit hot and cold, and it looks as though he's blowing quite hot at the moment.
And Yoni Zaguirre in there for Bahrain Merida. I mean, I know the mountains and the climbing hasn't been that demanding yet, but riding high in fifth place overall, and Tony Gallopin up there as well, which probably puts it all into context, really, doesn't it? Those two riders still in the top six after nine stages does give you an indication that the climbing hasn't really begun yet. It's kind of all backloaded towards Andorra, isn't it? It's almost Giro-esque.
Well, Lionel, I said, and I was mocked by the Buffalo at the tour after about 10 days, I said, effectively, we shouldn't get too excited about Simon Yates yet, because what he's done is he's won a slightly difficult edition of Tirreno Adriatico. The race at that point had gone from the Tyrrhenian Sea to the Adriatic Sea, pretty much. What Simon Yates has done thus far is he's pretty much won a Ruta del Sol. It's true, isn't it? Ruta del Sol is a bit, okay, it's 5 or 6 days these days? What you just said about Gallopin underlines that. I think there's been one very hard climb so far, and that was today.
Miguel Angel Lopez, Superman. Big support for him and Urán at the finish, of course, as there always is for the Colombians. He's moved up from 12th to 7th. Sort of stealthy, hidden move, really, but was looking frisky on the front along with Wilco Kelderman. I mean, again, appearances are what you're looking for, those signs rather than just the results on the line, aren't you? And he certainly looked willing to try something.
Yeah, and I think Kelderman, when you think of the climbing pedigree and also where some of these riders are from, you know, Urán, Lopez and Quintana all look good today, all live and hail from over 2,000 metres above sea level. And then you look at how well Kelderman is climbing. You have to think that it was a big shame that he lost that time the other day, because if he hadn't lost around about, what was it, a minute and 37 or just over a minute and a half, he would almost be looking like the leader in the clubhouse at the moment, or the virtual red jersey, wouldn't he? With his time trialing pedigree, probably he's probably a minute better than almost all of the other general classification contenders in a 30-kilometre time trial, which we've got coming in Cantabria next week.
I had a close look at Kelderman's physique this evening after you mocked me. I mean, he looks like he's made of matchsticks. I mean, he's not a beefy man.
Yeah, but he's a time trial. He's a ruler climber.
On account of his height?
On account of the fact that he's better. He's much more of a ruler than he's a climber.
Yeah, but these are the riders that are coming to the fore, aren't they? They're sort of the rangy, stick thin Chris Froome, the rangy, stick thin Tom Dumoulin. To me, they are the climbers.
So Dumoulin's a climber.
Of course he's a climber. He's finished second in the Giro and
But no one's gonna agree. Lionel, no, stop digging your heels in. No one is gonna agree with you on this. No one. That's like, is Ilner Zakarin a climber?
He can climb well, but he's not as good.
Is he the traditional? Does he correspond to the traditional definition of a climber?
Okay, look at that top 17.
We were arguing last night over dinner about what constituted middle class and working class. Anyway, this is very similar. Very similar. The rule book's been rewritten over the last few years. Same with the class system, isn't it?
It has indeed. Very lastly, Daniel, before we all have to get off this mountain, well, you certainly have to get off this mountain because it's your rest day tomorrow, and your accommodation looks absolutely stunning for the rest day. The buffalo will be stampeding in and putting his hooves up for a very relaxing afternoon.
Never mind Ben King, we're staying in a castle.
Fabio Aru, 11th, 1:08 down. Almost invisible, almost a la Zubeldia for Aru. Have you picked up any vibes from Team UAE? I mean, he's in the mix, isn't he? And he's had an absolute shocker of a year and a bit.
Well, I said Iran blows hot and cold. Aru certainly does. I spoke to him this morning. He seems a bit sheepish still about his ambitions overall. He owes the team a result on general classification. He was under a lot of pressure after the Giro earlier this year, and his coach Paolo Tirolonga, the former Astana rider, looked as though he was going to be sacked or dispatched, but he's here at the Vuelta, in fact. And there were stories after the Giro that Aru had gone for testing and he'd changed his diet, and I think he's cut out gluten now. But he's not pulling up any trees, is he? And he looks at the moment as though someone who might contend for a place in the top 7 or 8, but I haven't been terribly impressed by him so far, but
We'll see. Daniel, this is the end of the road for me and you here at the Vuelta. Good luck with the Buffalo and Fran next week. I think we can all agree that after today's football results, it's been an absolutely tremendous day for sport. I mean, sport has been the winner. And just a seamless segue into our sponsor's message from Science in Sport.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport.
Kiss goodbye to stomach problems with the world's first truly isotonic gel. Science in Sport, Go Energy Isotonic. Before you hit the wall, hit back.
Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Now, just before I set off for the Vuelta, I got an email from Stephen Moon, the boss of Science in Sport, congratulating us on our pre-Vuelta episode, saying he'd enjoyed listening, wishing me luck for the Vuelta, and revealing that he'd been looking through all of the sales and he'd seen a huge order of Science in Sport products placed by Watford Football Club, who beat Tottenham Hotspur 2-1 today and are unbeaten in the Premier League. I'm absolutely delighted that Science in Sport are powering Watford Football Club. And if you would like to get 25% off all of Science in Sport's products, you can go to the website scienceinsport.com, enter the code, it's SISCP25 as usual, and 25% off. Can't say fairer than that. I'm now with Dutch journalist Dan Hakkenberg of Algemeen Dagblad, Dutch newspaper. How are you doing, Dan?
Myself? Pretty fine, actually.
Pretty fine, yeah. Well, you're going home as well tomorrow, but you're coming back because there's a lot of Dutch interest here in this Vuelta with Team Lotto NL Jumbo, of course, Wilco Kelderman of Sunweb, and Bauke Mollema of Trek Segafredo. Now, with 10 kilometres to go, if you'd said to me, bet some money on the stage winner, I would have put a lot of money on Mollema reeling in Ben King.
Yeah.
What happened?
Well, first of all, you got a lot of money. I don't have, so let's make that clear, first of all.
I was talking maybe 50 euros.
Oh, no, that's for Dutch understanding, that's a lot of money. No, I would have put it on Bauke as well. He closed the gap quite fast. 1.5 minutes became a minute, became 30 seconds. But he, how do you say it in English? He got stuck over there.
He blew.
Yeah. And he was quite honest. He could see him, Ben King, but there was no way he could come closer in the last K. He made a wrong bet by letting King go. He was honest about that. It was a tactical mistake, and he was thinking that Thomas De Gendt might be stronger. But at a certain point, De Gendt told Bauke, "If you want something today, you better get along, or you better get away, because I'm not going to make it today." So he depended on Thomas De Gendt, who was good in these sort of stages, but Thomas De Gendt wasn't there in the final. So the time Mollema lost with thinking, talking, etc., was the time he got short on the last case.
And he did get very close. There was one bit, maybe 2.5 kilometres to go, where he could see Ben King up ahead, and it must have been agonising for him. But King looks smoother. Mollema's style is quite awkward anyway. He's got a curved back, and he rocks a bit. But he did look strong for a while. Do you think it's just the fact that he's had the Tour de France as well and a lot of racing?
No, he had a lot of racing, but did it quite easy coming to the Vuelta. Ben King really trained for this, and Ben King said something nice about it. He said, with the hard circumstances of the last 9 days, with the extreme hot temperatures, everybody is losing their level. He said guys like Mollema, he feared Mollema a lot, he feared a guy like Thomas De Gendt a lot, but he said, I think it's because of these circumstances these guys don't get on the top on these days. That might be true, actually.
So disappointment for Mollema, but he'll try again another day in the middle week or even the final week.
He's here to prepare for the World Championships as a one-day race as well. So he will probably be one of the main men of the Dutch squad, together with, Tom Dumoulin and even Wout Poels. These three guys showed in the past that they can do it in one-day races or stage wins.
Now, what about Wilco Kelderman? Because he lost that time a few days ago when there was the crash, very unlucky. Didn't have much support from Sunweb that day, it didn't look like anyway. And today he looked very lively, looked like the strongest of the GC guys. Still 1 minute 50 down, but what's the mood of Kelderman at the moment?
His mood is good, but I guess he will think about this mechanical 3 days ago a lot. Because in nowadays cycling in the Grand Tours, we see that time gaps of a minute, 2 minutes, you don't make it up that easily. We've seen it in the Tour de France with his teammate Tom Dumoulin and a front wheel crash on the Mur de Bretagne. It cost him a minute. Not losing that minute, we would have seen a more tensed last days in the Tour de France. I guess to lose 2 minutes on the Vuelta, even when you got terrible good climber's legs and a TT coming up, might be just a bit too much for Wilco Kelderman. He showed, like you said, he was probably the strongest of the GC guys today. Only Lopez and Quintana were able to follow. They didn't want to cooperate with him, he said. Nairo was just sitting there, but he wanted to pull because he needed to make up time. He did some, a couple of seconds on a couple of guys, but even a half a minute almost on guys like Kruiswijk, Ahu. So there's progression.
Yeah, it's progression, but there's still 12 or 13 guys ahead of him. It's a lot of bodies to get past. They've all got to sort of lose a little bit here and there. The time trial will help him a lot, of course. But the other thing in his favour is he must be incredibly fresh. You pointed out to me in the press room earlier on today, Dan, how little racing Kelderman has done this year. This was his 31st day of racing this season. He did, I think from memory, the Tirreno Adriatico, and he crashed on the last day. I think did his collarbone in that race. He came back in the Tour de Suisse. Then, shortly after the Tour de Suisse, was the Dutch National Championships, where he crashed again and missed the Tour de France.
Again, his collarbone.
Again, the collarbone. And so he's come here with just training. I mean, this is a good level to be at. But do you think, is there a worry that 3 weeks, might end up being too much after such a light season?
I don't think so at all, actually. It might even be an advantage for Wilco, because he will probably get more hardness. He will be getting better in the upcoming weeks, probably. That's what he's saying himself. The thing is, you already mentioned it, he's remarkably good when he comes out of a training period. He's got so unlucky last year, but even this year, like we just said, two collarbones injuries in not even a healthy year. He was on podium spot in the Tirreno, crashed out, was on podium spot at Tour de Suisse again, and missed it because of a bad TT, because of this pain in his collarbone. I remember seeing him riding on the first days of Switzerland. It was crazy. It was bad weather, small roads, dusty, dirty. Everybody would understand if a guy like Wilco Kelderman in these stages say, well, you know, it's fine with me, I take it a bit more slow, I'm just back in the peloton. But what you see, he's got no fear. He's there, he's good, without fear, racing like he has never been away. And it's the same in the Vuelta this year, but he's got the last of almost 2 minutes. And that was, what was funny, he's mentally quite strong. He was telling after the mechanic problem, luckily I didn't crash. So that's the only advantage he got. He lost time, but not because of a crash. He's not injured, the legs are good, so I think he might be the man for the upcoming weekend in the Asturias.
It's a lot of time that I lost, so that's really yeah, I will see. It's still quite early in the Vuelta. Two hard stages done now, so I will see next week. You know, always in the Vuelta that is really hard every day. Yeah, also the heat and everything, circumstances really hard. So yeah, you see that a lot of riders getting problems. For sure, I felt not really great in the first week. I had some few good days, but I raced not for a long time and I need to come into the race rhythm, and now it's getting better. The feeling's getting better.
Well, he was fourth overall last year, of course, so, you know, the podium definitely not out of the question, and I think still in the mix. But the way Nairo Quintana moved into such close up to the top of the GC, and just, he always goes better in the second Grand Tour of a season. Ominous, that looks to me. But one team, along with Movistar, who's always have numbers in the climbs, one team that's been very visible, not just because they're in Watford colours, yellow and black, is Lotto NL Jumbo, of course. Now, Steven Kruiswijk is the big Dutch star there, but also have Kiwi, George Bennett, and the American, Sepp Kuss, who's again looked impressive today. Did a great ride.
Sepp Kuss rode like crazy today. It was like he's been here for years. And he was at ease as well in the last in the final. The thing is, they were even, both of them, George Bennett and Kruiswijk, were a bit disappointed afterwards. They were there, like you said, with the numbers, but they couldn't finish it off. Actually, of all GC favorites, they didn't lose minutes today. But the guys who lost half a minute, for example, that were George Bennett and Steven Kruiswijk.
Yeah, they lost a little bit there, didn't they? Just off the very best guys. Is the worry that they've got such consistency to, like in the Tour, fifth and sixth, I think, in the end, was it? Or was it, no, fourth and fifth. Yeah. Fourth and fifth, of course, with Roglic and Kruiswijk. You could see them here doing the same, couldn't you? Fourth and fifth, or fifth and sixth. But has either of them got what it takes to be in the top three?
Top three might be a bit hard, even with Kruiswijk already have ridden a Grand Tour, the Tour de France. George Bennett should be a bit more fresher. The problem is, he never done it before, so it's the first. If he would be top three, it's the first time. So that's a bit hard as well. On the other hand, there might be a bit more success of the third guy over there, Danny van Poppel. He's getting close. He's getting closer and closer, and he will have an advantage by the other sprinters having hard times. Van Poppel should maybe the guy for day success for them this Vuelta.
Well, he was impressive yesterday on the finish that was for Valverde and Sagan, and he was the only real sprinter that was up there. He was in third place.
Yeah, and his trainer told me that he should keep his calm, Danny, this first year they have ridden, let him ride two Grand Tours just to get him, give him more stamina, more. They want to let him grow. He the last years on Sky, he just fall back a bit. So actually, he doesn't have to win this year, but he wants really, really bad. So you might see him up there the upcoming weeks.
Nice one, Dan. Thanks very much. You're back off to the Netherlands for a few days, and I guess unless the Dutch riders fall out of contention, they will be back out again before the weekend.
I guess so. So I surely miss the next Watford game.
That's enough Watford chat, Dan. And that's all from me here at the Vuelta 2018. I'm bowing out. I would like to say I'm going home to prepare for the Worlds, but I'm not going there either. But I'm heading off home, and Richard Moore is replacing me. And the Cycling Podcast will be back on Tuesday with Richard, Fran Reyes and Daniel Fried.